I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, an intergalactic conversation this time with big Boston roots. We're talking about a sort of tsunami of planets that astrophysicists at Harvard and MIT are getting to know rather a lot about. There's Kepler-421b, for example, with a year made up of 704 days. There's another planet in the so-called Goldilocks or habitable zone that is rocky like the Earth, but 17 times more massive. There are something like 10 billion planets that might sustain life out there. 700 more turned up since the start of this year, 2014. So what could be the nature of life on such places? Is it algae, viruses, moss, animals, birds, dinosaurs? And what is the chance of intelligent life, maybe smarter, more dangerous than we are? And remind me, why do we want to find it? Live in our studio, David Latham and Sarah Rugheimer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics are going to sort of whisk us through space at a turning point in the long history of astronomy. Latham, the astronomer, Rugheimer, the young boundary jumper into the realm of astrobiology. Then Jason Wright from the University of Pennsylvania leads the search for intelligent life on planets so advanced that they're already sending hints that they've overconsumed their energy resources. And then Dimitar Sasolov, a lead explorer in the Origins of Life mission at Harvard, has a thought about just why we look for something that we might not recognize when we see it. Just to frame the questions right, our producer Max Larkin asked a sample of kids in playgrounds around town just what they thought was out there.
I think there could be life on other planets, and it's pretty cool how they found so many other planets besides the ones that we know.
Maybe some have solid insides, liquid or gas.
There will have to be trees because that gives oxygen and everything.
Yeah, like the leaves on the trees might be blue.
Well, maybe there could be life forms.
Like aliens. I think aliens might be green. I don't think they wear clothes.
Maybe they can't talk. Maybe they don't have ears.
Maybe they breathe a different way, or maybe they don't have to breathe at all.
I think it may be like small-celled creatures, like little animals, not like humans. I don't know. Maybe a little weird to us, but might be really normal to them.
I don't think there are aliens. I would be very surprised. Shocked.
The kids are hip. So is Max Larkin. Let's remember, what we call astronomy, the observation of stars and planets, is the oldest of the natural sciences, tracked back 5,000 years and more B.C. David Latham, master of the field at Harvard, put this new burst of discoveries in the long context. How is it that the 20-teens, this moment, begin to look like a turning point?
We do live at a very special time in the history of astronomy, I'll say that. We are poised to not only discover planets enough like the Earth, but actually characterize them and show that they are enough like the Earth that life as we know it, carbon-based life, could conceivably be comfortable there. So I'm not talking about giant gas planets like Jupiter. I'm talking about rocky planets that have surfaces and are at the right distance from the host star that they orbit, that the temperature might be correct for water to be liquid on the surface. So kind of the Goldilocks zone that you mentioned earlier, not too close or too hot and not too far away and too cold. And also, very importantly, they have what we call secondary atmospheres, atmospheres that have been produced after the planets were formed and are compact atmospheres of interesting molecules. I mean molecules like water, the universal solvent, and carbon dioxide. You got to have that carbon for carbon-based life. And methane, you got to have nitrogen. You know, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, those are all critical for the invention, I call it, of life as we know it.
This gets ahead of it, maybe ahead of the game, but what if it's not carbon-based life? How many other kinds could there be?
We're like the drunk looking for the keys under the light post. We're looking for the kind of life that we know about. If we don't find that for hundreds of years, well, then maybe we'll start looking for silicon giraffes, to paraphrase Carl Sagan.
But why suddenly so many? We're told 100 billion planets in our Milky Way, our little humble Milky Way, and maybe 10 billion could be in the zone. I mean, where did this rush come from? Or is it that we have the technology to see them?
It's primarily new technology that has made this possible. It's technology for making very precise measurements about the motions of stars. It's the light from the stars that we see. And we infer that there are planets orbiting those stars by the very subtle motions, periodic orbital motions that we see in the star due to the unseen planet tugging on it. So that technology has improved a factor of almost 1,000 over the last 25 years. And that was the first big breakthrough. The second big breakthrough was the technology to measure very slight dips in the light coming from a star. For those special cases where the orbit of the planet was oriented edge-on to our line of sight, so we could see the shadow of the planet passing in front of the star and blocking a little bit of light. And in order to measure something the size of the Earth going between us and its host star, you have to be able to measure things at the 80 part per million level. And that's not something that we could do from the ground through the wavering Earth's atmosphere. You have to go to space for that. And that technology was developed just in the last 15 years.
Dave Latham, you're the planet guy in this conversation. Why don't you introduce Sarah Rugheimer and as the life gal, dare I say? I mean, make the connection.
So
the division of your labors.
The most exciting part about characterizing planets that are enough like the Earth that you can imagine perhaps life could survive there is that we now have the technological capability of remote sensing of the atmospheres of those planets. We are able to do spectroscopy of the light from those atmospheres. And we can even see something about the composition of those atmospheres, what kind of molecules are present. And we can tell something about the temperature of the top of the atmosphere. We can see the difference between the daytime when the side is facing its host star versus the nighttime when it's on the backside away from the host star. So that is the wonderful vision that we have, that with remote sensing from here in the neighborhood of the Earth and the solar system with space probes, we can sense the composition of the atmospheres and maybe even find some evidence of pollution of the atmosphere by life.
Sarah can do
that. And that is Sarah's specialty.
Yeah, well, this is what got me interested in astronomy. I actually was planning to go into medical physics, and I sat in on an astronomy conference and a session on remote sensing of life. And it just struck me that this is the first time in human history that we have the technology to be able to begin to answer this question of, are we alone in the universe? And I just had to become a part of it. And so that's really how I got interested into astronomy as a field as a whole and ended up at Harvard. And yeah, exactly as Dave was saying, we now have this technology to start to answer this question of, is there life on this planet? Is there water? Is it habitable? And either answer to this question is going to be immensely profound for all humans on this planet. And so that to me is just very exciting and why I get up every day and do astronomy.
You get up every day, go to the office and do what? Where do you look? And I'm worried about, you say infer planets, we remote sensing of planets. How close do we come to envisioning these things?
Sure. Well, I mean, these planets are very far away, right? So everything we're doing
Light years.
Light years away. So the way I like to think about it is the nearest star to us, other than the sun, is 4 light years away. So that's the distance that light takes to travel, you know, in a year is a light year. So, and the other way to think about this is 35 years ago, we sent Voyager. And that's the farthest probe we've sent into space, and it's about 1 light day. away from Earth right now. In 35 years, it has traveled only the distance that light takes to travel in one day. And the nearest star is 4 light years. So these things are immensely far from us. And so if Voyager were pointed at Alpha Centauri, it would take 70,000 years for it to get there. So we're not going to be able to go there right now. You know, this is all that we're able to do is look at things, look at the light that comes to us and try to infer what's happening on that planet. We can't send a microscope. That would be ideal, you know, if we had a warp time, you know,
send
warp
me.
Drive, exactly sort of thing where we can go and actually measure the life. That would be ideal, but we just can't. We're going to be doing everything from Earth by trying to look at what we know from biology. As Dave said, we know what carbon-based life looks like, so we're going to start there.
And what's your bet in answer to the Fermi paradox?
I definitely think there's life out there. I think we will find evidences of life. I made a bet with a friend at Harvard that in 50 years. So I was a little maybe more pessimistic than NASA's recent.
What in 50 years?
That we'll find biosignatures, signs of microbial life, not necessarily intelligent advanced life, but signs that single-celled organisms exist on a planet around another star.
Single cell, that's pretty basic. What do you take as the sign?
Yeah, so these microbes, what's interesting, when you look on Earth, a lot of our atmosphere, the biosignatures in our atmosphere are dominated by microbes, you know, not necessarily the more complex life. And so when I say we're looking for single-celled organisms, it's in large part because they're so numerous, they have such a big impact on the atmosphere.
Well, even non-scientists like me are conditioned by now to know that it's the microbial life that really sustains all of us.
Yeah.
We're just sort of celebrity fauna on all of that much more basic stuff. We're talking about a sudden rush of confidence that there is life out there among billions and billions of planets, something like us. Coming up, Jason Wright at Penn State is looking at planets, maybe with technology, maybe with energy hunger already. Sounds sort of familiar. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're out among the exoplanets, billions and billions of them with suns sort of nearby. Question is, which ones have water and the right chemicals to sustain what we call life? Stephen Hawking, the English cosmologist, says it sounds like exactly the sort of life we'd be wise to stay away from.
So if aliens ever visit us, I think the outcome would be much as when Christopher Columbus first landed in America. Which didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans.
Our guest, Jason Wright, is an astronomer on the edge at Penn State. Jason Wright, tell us what you're doing and why you're not scared stiff by alien warriors or killer viruses. Welcome.
All right. Well, I guess the approach I'm taking is that if there are advanced civilizations out there, if we go beyond just the microbial life to multicellular life to life that has intelligence and can build machines, they're probably much more advanced than we are. They've had billions of years to develop their technology and build whatever it is advanced civilizations build. So the gap between them and us is probably much larger than the gap between Christopher Columbus and the Native Americans when he arrived. It might be more like the gap between us and the ants in the anthill in our backyard. And so I don't think there's much we can do to affect whether we eventually contact them and interact with them. So I'd like to know if they're out there and see what they're like. If there are these advanced civilizations out in the galaxy or even in other galaxies, then they might be much easier to detect than microbes. Because they're so advanced, they might have, you know, who knows what they have, gigantic spacecrafts and Death Stars and big star enshrouding solar collectors. We can only imagine what such an advanced civilization might do, but there's the possibility that they might command enormous amounts of energy and that they might have mega engineering of the sort that we would be able to notice here from Earth more easily than maybe, you know, pond scum in a tide pool on a distant planet. So I'm sort of jumping to the end of the line of reasoning that they might be out there and saying, well, if they're out there, they might be very, very obvious. And we now are just getting to the point where we have the technology, I think, to really tell if such super civilizations really exist.
Jason Ray, I mean, this is a totally different dimension from the, you know, scanning planets for signs of oxygen or something like that. You're supposing, and you use the word imagining, sort of Angkor Wat or Aztec civilizations, ruins of civilizations that came and went, developed faster, burned out sooner than ours did. But dare I ask, I mean, is this science fiction or is this science?
Well, we try to phrase searches for extraterrestrial intelligence as scientifically as possible, and we try not to make too many assumptions about what might be out there. But, I mean, we know that intelligent spacefaring life is possible in the galaxy because we're it. We have spacecraft. We've been to space in our own very small way. Mm-hmm. And there's no law of physics that says that we can't build much larger spacecraft. There's no law that says that we can't have colonies on other nearby stars. And there has been plenty of time in the history of the galaxy for a civilization like our own that might have arisen billions of years ago to have completely colonized the galaxy by now. And in fact, that's the heart of Enrico Fermi's paradox. He asked, where is everybody? Because a simple calculation shows that if a civilization like ours ever...
Lost you on the matter of Enrico Fermi's paradox, Sarah. I was just about to. He says there's no law of. Jason is saying there's no law of physics that it can't happen. Is there a law of biology that says it can happen, much less must happen?
Yeah. Well, I think we can. We don't have a lot of data yet, right? Since we only have Earth as our single point of life. But one thing I like to think about on Earth is that for the vast majority of time of life on Earth, it has been single-celled, and which is why I'm excited about searching for microbial life. And really, so Earth has been around for 4.6 billion years. And let's think of Earth, the Earth time as a full, like a year, a calendar year. So we have the first evidence of life coming up within the first few months of that calendar year. And it took all the way till about August before you started getting multicellular life, things that are bigger than just one cell. And then humans weren't on the scene until the last few hours of the last day. And so for when we look at our history of Earth, by the vast majority of time was single-celled. And that's what I think when we look out, we're going to hopefully see planets at similar stages where they do have life, but it might not be technological yet.
Jason Wright, leap back in. We lost you at Fermi's paradox.
All right. Well, my point was that there's been plenty of time, and so we don't see any evidence of a galaxy-spanning civilization, and that was Enrico Fermi's question. There's been enough time for such a civilization to span the galaxy, and we haven't yet noticed them, but we're starting to get to the point where I think maybe we could, and so we should go out and look and see if our galaxy or even other galaxies show evidence of that.
But I understand you're looking already for signs of the energy depletion that would come with an advanced technological system out there. What are you finding?
Right. So there are a few different approaches for looking for these large alien civilizations. And the particular one I'm taking is to note that anytime you use energy, you don't use it up. It doesn't disappear. You have to do something with it when you're done. So the same way that your computer, when it draws energy out of the wall, does interesting and useful work with that, you know, doing whatever your computer does, when it's done, your computer heats up and it gets rid of that energy as heat. And so if there are alien civilizations out there, and I'm trying to stay totally agnostic as to how they generate their energy, what they might do with all of that energy, but if they're using very large amounts of energy, then we should be able to see the heat that they give off when they're done doing whatever they do with it. Mm. And recently, NASA launched a satellite called WISE, which is very sensitive to this kind of heat, and it measured the amount of heat coming out of other galaxies. It measured the amount of heat coming off of stars. And so if there were very advanced civilizations using enormous amounts of heat, then this satellite would be sensitive enough to detect them. And so right now we're starting for the very largest civilizations, and we can show some pretty loose upper limits. Basically, as far as we can tell, there are no galaxies like the Milky Way that are completely filled with an alien civilization that's using up as much energy as all the starlight in the galaxy, or even about half the starlight in the galaxy. And as we get better at this and learn more about the heat that comes from galaxies and stars, we'll get more and more sensitive to smaller and smaller super civilizations like that.
Jason Wright, I should have welcomed you back to Boston University where you got a lot of your training, but I got a note here that David Latham is smiling wisely as you speak, and I'm wondering, is this a stretch, David?
Well, I look at our own civilization, and there may not be any laws of physics that prevent us from colonizing the solar system. Ooh, that's a long shot from the nearest stars. But on the other hand, maybe there are laws of economics or willpower of our civilization to do that. How long ago was it that we landed on the moon? How come we haven't gone back? How come we haven't gone to Mars yet? We don't think we can afford it, most people.
Well, and this is a question that I actually had asked to me when I went to the parking office to get my visitor parking permit. And the man asked me, he said, you know, what do you do? I said, I'm an astronomer. He's like, why should we fund NASA? I don't think we should fund NASA. You know, I was put on the spot. And I quickly, hastily put together, well, I think there's really three reasons, you know. And one of them is that, you know, often Americans think that NASA is 20% of the budget. It's not. It's 0.5%. If you were to break up the entire federal budget into a dollar, it's less than half a penny. And it used to be, as Dave was saying, when we were going to the moon, it was around 4%. So I think, you know, we have deprioritized a lot of this as a country. And then the second reason why I think we should fund NASA, though, is that many technologies that we enjoy have come from NASA. Satellite technology that has led to weather monitoring, GPS, even improvements in eye surgery, tennis shoe material came from NASA. And so they estimate a $7 return on the investment for every dollar spent.
But let's get back out to the planets. Go ahead.
You know, pragmatically, I think it's important. You know, and then so this is why, you know, when we go to these questions, we do have the money. It's just not allocated right now towards some of these larger missions. And hopefully that'll change in the future and we will overcome this economic hurdle that Dave is talking about.
Jason.
I guess I agree with Dave's skepticism about the economics of populating the galaxy. I'll point out it only takes, one successful colony to seed another star, and then that star can do its own thing. And it's certainly true that it doesn't look like humanity is very good at that sort of large project. But of course, we are talking about alien civilizations that, for all we know, might be better about it. But my approach is that, we could argue about the likelihood, but we can also look. We can just see if it happened and constrain it. If we don't see any large civilizations, that tells us something. And so we should try to ground the argument in data as much as we can. So I agree that something like this is a long shot. But I also think that it's worth at least some of our resources, of my resources, but not necessarily a lot. For instance, most of my research is, in fact, looking for exoplanets and looking for these potential habitats for microbial life. It's only a small part of my portfolio on this real long shot of trying to improve our SETI detection. And I know that that Dave Latham's been involved in some optical SETI projects at Harvard as well. And so it's in terms of the cost benefit, we should spend a little bit of money looking for SETI and looking for the really big things. But we know that we're going to find Earth-like planets. And we know that there's an excellent chance that some of those planets are going to have something like microbial life. And so that's where we should be focusing most of our efforts. And that's where
Let's assume it's a good investment. Come back to your notion, Jason Wright, though, that we're working on the hypothesis that civilizations out there might be much more advanced than ours. Perfectly possible.
Almost certain if they're, yeah.
They could also be, you hate to think of the wreckage that we could bring to a less advanced planet. But what damage could your hyper advanced earlier evolving planet do to us? I mean, there is a danger here. I mean, I'm ready to welcome the folks from wherever it is, but they're going to be armed and dangerous if you're right.
I mean, trying to speculate what they might be like sociologically, whether we could communicate with them, I don't know. I try to stay agnostic about that sort of thing. I imagine that if there is such a civilization, it must be billions of years old, and so even further removed, perhaps, than we are from ants. So whether they would even notice us, whether it's possible to communicate with them, it might be a very diverse sort of civilization with different technology levels. I have no idea. We can't, you know, travel fast enough to go visit them. They would have to come visit us, I think, at least in the near future. But yeah, I have no idea. I agree, though, that it'd be up to them how the interaction went. I don't think we would have much say in the matter.
Hmm. How will we know? What would you take as evidence? I mean, it's hard for a layman to hear an esteemed scientist say he has no idea. How what would give you an idea?
Of whether an alien civilization would be dangerous if we encountered them?
Well, no, first, that it's out there.
Oh,
and that it's got us in its scope.
Okay, so the line from a potential detection of maybe waste heat this heat from an alien civilization to showing that it's of intelligent origin, that's a very long road to plow, because as scientists, we always have to reach for the natural explanation first. So if we really wanted to say, look, we've got them, we've seen them, we know that there's intelligence out there, it will probably be from some unambiguous signal, I suspect, something like a radio signal or a laser signal from the alien civilizations that's clearly intelligent origin, clearly some sort of communication. And then if it's something that we're supposed to be able to interpret, we'd learn a lot. It could be that we're just intercepting communication between them, and then it would be like Thomas Edison trying to interpret a fiber optic cable or something. We might have no idea how to interpret it.
I keep wondering whether it's an advanced civilization out there would be more different from us, more like ants, less like Aztecs or Khmers, or, I mean, these things are just human neighbors. But what if it's something radically different? What if it's, you know, organized wheat kernels or something?
I think it would have to be radically different. I try to stay agnostic about what it might be like, but we look, as Dave said, under the lamppost, because we understand carbon-based life, and you can't just go look for anything that might be weird. You have to specify the range of your search. But it's very possible it won't be anything like carbon-based life. It might be something completely, completely alien.
Like what? And I want to get Sarah and Dave in on this too. Imagine it. I mean, imagine it as scientists.
It's a really hard question, right? And I think this comes back to, you know, the Fermi paradox. Like, where are they? Is it just because we don't know how to interpret their signals? That's actually my preferred solution to the paradox, because we only know, we're so limited in our understanding of, you know, carbon-based life. We have this one example. I mean, I've read science fiction books postulating life being these sort of magnetic toroids in the sun, you know, and all sorts of weird, bizarre things. We just don't know. You know, we know that complex chemistry can form easily with carbon, and we know that carbon's very abundant, and we know that water's very abundant, and we know that planets are very abundant. So I think there's a good chance that the life will have some similarities, or at least some life in the universe will have some similarities to us and be carbon-based.
Dave Latham.
Are there technical civilizations out there? I mean, there might be civilizations who don't care about technology. So if we're going to look for a signal from another civilization, they've got to be interested in building devices, machines, lasers, radio transmitters, something. And it's so far been unsuccessful, the effort to look for obvious signals from another technical civilization. We've really only scratched the surface. We have not made very complete searches, but it is worth some effort in my view. It's a very long shot that will detect and understand signals, but just imagine the payoff. It's a shortcut to learning something about another civilization. Presumably, they will be interested in telling us something about themselves. Do they live on a planet? What kind of a planet? Around which star? And therefore, I think it's worth some investment. It's a very long shot, but it's a shortcut to learning about another civilization.
Some investment. That sounds very skeptical. That sounds rather Republican, cut the budget in spirit, Dave. Do you mean it that way?
You mean how much investment should we make?
Yeah, and with what odds, so to speak? It's got to be a long shot, but...
We are not doing as good a job as we could, but we're doing a pretty decent job. And the technology is getting better all the time so that we can get much better frequency coverage of the electromagnetic spectrum and we can get better time coverage. But if we were really serious about this, again, the laws of economics wouldn't allow it, we'd invest heavily. But it's a long enough shot that I'm not sure that's worth it.
Let me just say, I'm a little worried about the sort of... an analogy in medicine. Pharmacology gets so refined, we have a pill for almost anything. Then we got to go out and find a disease that it can cure. And, you know, sometimes in certain occasions you think we're inventing these diseases because we've got something to treat them with. Are we sure that the planets are quite as real as the telescopes, I guess, is my question. Coming up, the philosophical riddles and surprises in store. What is life after all? Not just the chemistry of it, but the meaning of it from an entirely different starting point. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. On the accelerating rush to other planets and maybe new life, we all grew up naturally enough as Earth-first patriots, us at the center of things, but of course there are other angles. Douglas Adams in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy jolted us with this one. He said, "We live on an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet with an ape-descended population so primitive we think digital watches are a big deal." Dimitar Sasolov is inspired by the differences in perspective. He's an astronomer trained in Bulgaria with a yen for biology. He runs an interdisciplinary Origins of Life project at Harvard, and his book on exoplanets is what got us hooked on this business 3 or 4 years ago. The other day, he gave us this account of what drives him.
We want to find things which can't even be imagined. I mean, that is why we explore, Chris. I mean, this is why we love exploring, because, yes, we seem to be diminutive and remarkable, really flawed in many ways. But then, this is really the biggest thing about us, humans, and maybe the whole tree of life on this planet, is that it cannot really sit still on the planet. We have to explore. And if you want me to define what human intelligence and technology is all about, it is about exploration. That is really the bottom line of what we are to me. And this is our future, because this planet is doomed. Planets and stars only last that many billion years. And if we don't leave the planet eventually, the planet will be gone and life on it as well. So if you think about life in a bigger galactic scale, if that is a phenomenon to survive and prosper and be big in the future of this observable universe, it has to leave its roots, its home planets. So I do think we are significant. I mean, I like Douglas Adams, and I know why he says what he says, and I would say the same thing. But where we are significant is that we can transcend the lifetime of planets and stars. Essentially, life, once it emerges, is a phenomenon that has the potential of eternity.
So we're talking about all manner of questions about life out there and certain amount of evidence too. May I just revert to the big question about what life is and might be out there? I think it was Stephen Jay Gould raised the question or made the observation that if you started this movie, this life movie, in the opening credits, the opening titles, started it again from the beginning, it would go differently. It would have a different ending. It would have a different course, a different trajectory, a different notion of heroism or love or resolution or storytelling. Go back to this whole matter of how different you can imagine this story being told. Sarah Ruckheimer, David Latham, and from Penn State, Jason Wright.
Yeah, I think what you hit upon is a very good point. Life works through evolution. And the one definition of life that NASA uses is that life is a self-sustained chemical system capable of undergoing evolution, of undergoing Darwinian evolution. And that means different forcings, different events on a planet, maybe an asteroid impact, other, you know, cold snowball sort of scenarios could affect life to go in a completely different path. There's this quote I really like from a scientist that said, you know, there's one that says it's a long way to go from slime to Mozart. But it's a really long way to go from HCN, just a simple molecule, to even slime. So when we think about the vast diversity of life on this planet, yes, you're exactly right. I don't even know if we're capable of imagining all the different possibilities it could have taken.
Over to you, Jason Wright. Imagine for us.
When I remember in grade school reading a book by National Geographic called Our Universe, and in it, each planet in the solar system had an imagined creature living in the habitat of that planet. And in Jupiter, which has no solid surface, there were these gas bags that were floating in the air, and all of the life on the planet was airborne all of the time. And there were things with wings and things that floated, and there was a whole ecosystem. And on Pluto, incredibly cold, there were these crystalline creatures that had somehow developed biology that was purely crystalline without any solvents, because everything is a solid on Pluto. And so I think science fiction is filled with these sorts of thought experiments. You could even imagine life as there's a famous story by Hoyle about the black cloud, an enormous cloud that was thinking and was itself an intelligent creature. There's all sorts of possibilities.
I like that one.
I wouldn't know where. I'm not nearly as imaginative as these authors.
Dave Latham, do you want to?
Yeah,
play this game, or do you want to tell us what you're actually going to do next month and next year?
No. I'm going to take my prerogative of being a grumpy old guy and say that I've heard the words billions and billions thrown out a couple of times tonight. Billions of planets that
we're pretending to be
rocky.
Carl Sagan.
Yes, and billions of years for life. And it reminds me of a wonderful Gary Larson cartoon. It has the young Carl Sagan looking up at the sky saying, "Look, there are hundreds and hundreds of stars." And we know about hundreds and hundreds of planets. We have indirect evidence for hundreds and direct pictures of a handful. But we don't have direct, we don't see directly billions. We're extrapolating to what must be out there if the rest of our galaxy is like the local neighborhood. Same thing for the lifetime of our technical civilization. How long have we had radio communication? Well, it's not even hundreds, it's barely 100. And how about civilization? That's a blink of an eye. How about civilizations that have lived half of the lifetime of the galaxy? What have they learned how to do? They've learned how to control their environment, how not to use up all the raw materials like gallium that are so essential for computers and so on. So it's so hard to imagine what a civilization would be like that has had billions of years.
Well, Sarah, your turn.
What I think we need to also focus on is what are we going to be able to detect? What is remotely detectable from Earth? So certainly life can, you know, science fiction has this whole realm of fantasy of what life might be like, but what are we actually going to recognize? And so when I think of remote detection of life, and I'm not saying that life couldn't exist around a Jupiter-like planet or on a Jupiter-type atmosphere, but we're never going to be able to detect that from Earth. And so I think the question pragmatically needs to be, what can we be able to interpret? And so that's where we're going to look first. And then as we do more experiments in the lab on Earth and look at maybe other possible biochemistries, we'll be able to expand where we look. But right now, I think we have to distinguish between what where life could possibly exist. It could exist anywhere. You know, we talk about Europa, the icy moon around Jupiter, and life existing in the oceans there. It certainly could exist. And that environment's been stable for billions of years. But we're never going to see it. If we can't see it from Earth and it's in our next door, you know, our next door neighbor, we're never going to see it around another planet in our technological, you know, 100-year future.
As you're saying, David, there's a time dimension here that I want to know more about, especially because scientists think about it differently. Dimitar Saslav speaks of, you know, 14 billion years since the Big Bang.
Yeah,
and he says, you know, it's a young universe. And I know what he's driving at. He also says we should be sending probes to some of these plausible planets. And how long would it take there to get there, you know, light years away? And he says it's nothing. I mean, granted, it might be 10,000 years before some advanced rocket could get there. And for him, there's a payoff. He's not going to be here to, you know, get the rocks back. How do you deal with this, as a matter of intellectual sort of commitment, but motivation for what you're doing, to think in those time dimensions? Jason, maybe that's yours.
Well, I like Dimitar's comment that life has the potential of eternity, that it intelligent life has the ability not only to destroy itself, but to prevent its own destruction from natural causes. And if it can colonize other stars, it can separate to the point where it couldn't destroy itself if it wanted to, if it could span the galaxy. And so when we're looking for these very large civilizations, I think of that in some ways looking, trying to see our future, because if we look in another galaxy and we could find evidence that it's filled with a civilization, then that means that there's the possibility, however remote, based on, you know, human sociological laws, that might be us in a couple billion years or less. And if the universe doesn't seem to have any of those, then there might be something we're missing here. And so that's why I think we need to search, because that's a data point that we can have if we spend the effort on it. And I want to know if it's happened or not.
I have to be cynical here. The people that run our civilization are in office for 2 years or 6 years, or maybe for life if they're a dictator. But they're not thinking in terms of thousands of years or even hundreds of years. They're thinking about 10 years from now.
But raises another question. Why does all of this stuff, I mean, what you're finding is fascinating, but why does it seem somehow more plausible, uncrazy, maybe urgent to a citizen like me than it did 10, 20, 30 years ago? It was science fiction 30 years ago.
Because now we know there are lots of small planets. We didn't know that 5 years ago. That's what the Kepler mission has shown us. Sure, the first planets that we found around other stars were big ones, easy to find, but we didn't know how many small ones, 10 times smaller, like the size of the Earth, there were. Kepler has shown us that those are almost 10 times more common than the big ones in close orbits. That's a fantastic result. We know there's something worth looking for now. And since there's so many of them, the chances are that the nearest ones are going to be pretty nearby and we can actually study them.
Sarah Ruckheimer, why do scientists and plain folk feel this is somehow a cause of the moment?
Well, you know, I want to bring it back to where were we 100 years ago? You know, barely 100 years ago, we were crossing the country in covered wagons. And we then, within 100 years, people were alive who went across the country in covered wagons, and they witnessed the first man on the moon. Where are we going to be in 100 years? And I think right now, like I said, technology is moving so fast, and we're at that cusp of being able to answer some of these big questions of, are we alone? And this question of, are technological civilizations, do they last long? Are they able to, you know, get past that technological infancy of not destroying themselves, or do they by and large destroy themselves? And I think as humans, we really want to know what are our chances, and by looking for life in other civilizations, this is one way to start to look at this question. question.
Dimitar Sasolov puzzled me. He said, I mean, don't you realize these planets are doomed? We're doomed. I mean, these things are only good for about a billion or, you know, several billion years. Do you feel...
Well, I mean, we're doomed in the sense that eventually, you know, Earth will not be habitable. But that is so far in our future. I mean, you know, we've only been humans. Anatomically, modern humans have been around for 200,000 years. You know, we've had written history for like 10,000 years. The Earth still has a good, you know, couple billion years in it. So where we're going to be in a couple billion years, I hope not still on Earth. We do need to get off planet. We do need to eventually colonize at least the solar system, go to Mars, and hopefully to other planets. For a long-term sustained civilization, you just have to, because as Dimitar said, planets don't last forever. But they last a long time.
Where will we be in 5 years? Where will we be at the blossoming of your young careers, Sarah and Jason? What are you going to do next week, Dave? I mean, what's
well, my
up? What?
Career is going to be longer than that, Chris.
But you've got a big project underway that we should know something about.
Oh, well, it's this same vision that we've alluded to, that we hope to reach the point where we can remotely sense biomarkers, molecules that are the product of life, and there's no if, and, or but. You know, that's going to be hard. I mean, suppose you find oxygen together with methane and argue, well, you have to continually supply the oxygen and methane because they're in disequilibrium. But that doesn't prove there's life there. There might be some other way you can make it.
Send the probe anyway.
We're trying to think through more carefully what the biomarkers ought to be. We have something called the Alien Earth Initiative that is looking at that issue of what molecules we might look for. Well, some of us look for the planets that we might look for them on.
Jason, what are you doing next week and next year? And how far do you hope the science to get, you know, in the course of your career?
Well, I'm very excited about missions like TESS that are going to find more and small planets around the very nearest stars. Kepler's given us some amazing statistics and told us about the frequency of planets in the galaxy. I think the next frontier are our neighbors. We want to meet the neighbors. We want to map out the neighborhood. We want to know how many Earth-like planets there are around the very nearest stars. I mean, if someone is seriously going to consider sending a probe that won't get somewhere for 100,000 years, we better make sure that, you know, we know where it's going and something about what it's going to see. So I want to know what planets are orbiting the nearest sun-like stars and whether there's a solar system analog sitting right in our cosmic backyard.
Sarah.
Well, and I work on the question, you know, next week and this week of what are these biosignatures? Could non-life produce them? Could we have false positives? And what is going to be our confidence in when we see a biosignature, is it life? And it's never going to be 100%. I think it's you know, we're going to be able to say this planet likely has life. You know, unless it's waving at us and saying, hello, Earth, it's going to be very difficult to have an unambiguous evidence. But we can look at statistically, see what's likely, and hopefully get an answer. And so that's at the end of my career, I would like to have some idea of, are we alone in the universe?
Can you imagine sending something out for a closer look?
Oh, yeah. I think it would be great to send a probe. Obviously, we won't get the answer in my lifetime unless I cryogenically freeze myself and wake up in 10,000 years.
Do it. This has been hugely interesting, but also in some weird way uplifting. Thank you, David Latham, Sarah Rugheimer, Jason Wright, and Dimitar Sasolov. Thanks also to Robert Kirshner at Harvard, Josh Wynn, and John Johnson. There's a whole lot more on our website where we're guessing and asking you to guess at answers to the original Fermi paradox. Musically, we're going out on Sun Ra's Rocket Number 9. Our show was produced by Kunal Jasti and Max Larkin and our engineer George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our alien overlord, proof of the varieties of life. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source. Rocket number 9 came off on the planet Venus. Rocket number 9 came off on the planet Venus.